You are tuning into Pro Bono Perspectives, live from Brooklyn, where the city never sleeps and purpose is more than just a buzzword. Pro Bono Perspectives brings together leaders that have traveled across sectors, industries, and experiences on their path to creating change for the communities in which they live and work. And I'm your host, Danielle Holly, CEO of Common Impact, a national nonprofit that designs skills-based volunteer programs that amplify the impact of social change organizations by harnessing the talents and the skills of private sector employees. I am lucky enough to cross paths with these leaders every day through my work with Common Impact and can't wait to bring you behind the scenes to share their stories. On today's podcast, we are diving into the state of philanthropy. We have Edgar Villanueva, currently an SVP at the Schott Foundation and is now a nationally recognized expert on social justice in philanthropy. I'm sure many of you have heard his name and read his book, Decolonizing Wealth, which is a now best-selling book offering compelling alternatives to the current dynamics of philanthropy, and in particular, ones that leverage the wisdom and the insights of Indigenous culture. He shares how philanthropy has, and the extent to which it has ignored Indigenous people and organizations, and how he's working from within the philanthropic community and world to change all of that, and why he describes himself as an angelic troublemaker. Welcome to the podcast, Edgar. So excited to have you here today.
Thanks for having me on.
So I want to get into your background and your career in just a moment. But before we go there, I want to start with this line from the very beginning of your book, Decolonizing Wealth, which is, "Philanthropy, honey, it's time for an intervention," which I loved. So true. I mean, you're saying that from inside the walls of the philanthropic sector, right? What does that mean to you? What does it mean to decolonize wealth?
Yeah, that line makes me laugh every time a little bit because, you know, being Southern, you have my accent in a lot of ways and ways of expressing myself. And when I had a big New York Times feature, which was quite a moment for me, of all the things that they sort of pulled out of the book, the headline was "Philanthropy, honey, it's time for intervention." For me, what that statement says is that, you know, philanthropy, I do believe, is a sector and a force that can be used for good. You know, I've worked in this sector for 16 years now and have seen the importance of moving resources to the right people at the right time. And historically, philanthropy has played an important role in supporting the civil rights movement. And, you know, generosity in general, is this the good thing, right? Whether it's like institutional or just from person to person. But what I've seen, being an insider working inside the walls of these institutions for a while now, is that the express desire and mission often of charitable organizations just does not operationalize in a way that I think we want to really see happen. And there's a lot of talking and propaganda and marketing and websites and statements that are often put out. Again, I think with really good intentions, but when I begin to see data as a younger grant maker around where money was actually going and not going, I was sort of like flabbergasted, frankly. And, you know, I was charged and, you know, with moving money to marginalized communities, and I was hired because of my lived experience coming from, poverty, coming from a Native family and community. And when I got on the inside, I learned quickly that it was really more window dressing, and it was challenging to actually make any kind of change or to move money to places where I thought it really needed to go. And when I began to ask questions or to like push back at all, or even bring new ideas, they were really not welcomed at all. because ultimately philanthropy is a place that I think historically has awarded the status quo, and you're made to feel that you're lucky to have been chosen to be a part of that community. The real transformative change really was not something that most foundations are looking to support. And I got harsher, perhaps, of my critique through the years as I wanted to see these changes happen. And I present the truth and love. I'm still a part of the sector. And so part of me is, you know, the philanthropy honey is like, I love you, but I've got to tell you the truth.
And so much of what you talk about in your book is how Indigenous worldviews can offer guidance in making that transformation that you're talking about, or that you're saying is needed. And how has you talked about coming from poverty and a Native background, how has that influenced your career and the way that you think about this work and your work right now?
You know, it's really everything to me, because as a young student and when I got into the workforce, I so internalized whiteness in a different way of being because I thought that's what I had to do to be successful. And, you know, lots of folks know the term code switching. This is just what a lot of people of color do because of white dominant culture and how in the mainstream we what we lift up to be success or who we see as experts. And so my family actually moved away from our Native community to Raleigh, the big city of Raleigh, North Carolina, when I started school. And I was the only Native American in my school until I got to college. And so being the only one, I was always feeling like I was in the other box and, you know, trying to fit in and figure out where I belong. And then, of course, all of the messages, again, that I was internalizing from media and the books I read and teachers and just all of the ways that I saw whiteness being lifted up, I tried to align myself with that way of being because out of survival, honestly. And so when I got into philanthropy professionally, that was a space where that forced assimilation was even like more multiplied. All of a sudden, not only did I need to assimilate to sort of a whiteness or a dominant type of leadership, I was in a very privileged, well-resourced type of exclusive community. And there were all these expectations that were put on me about what I represented and how I showed up in community, down to stories that I share in the book, you know, the type of car that I drove and, you know, wanting, you know, I remember there were comments about, you know, I'm representing the legacy of a wealthy family. So I needed to at all times, 24 hours a day, show up and be a certain kind of person. And so at a certain point in time, when I began to feel a frustration and emptiness around the work I was doing because it wasn't serving community or feeding me in the way that I knew that it should be, I started kind of searching for answers and, you know, maybe a different place I needed to be or work because I wasn't being fulfilled and I wasn't seeing the change. I wasn't being the type of change agent inside of philanthropy that I wanted to be in the world. And as I went on that journey, what I realized that it wasn't me so much as it was the sector and the space that I was working that was so riddled with white dominant culture and a dominant way of thinking. And I didn't need to read any more leadership books or do any more of the things, but I needed to actually remember who I was and tap back into those original instructions and that Indigenous wisdom that my grandparents passed down to my mom and my mom passed down to me. And it's really quite simple, but it was writing the book led me on a journey to explore all of that and to ask the questions of my elders about who I was and what was the type of leader that I needed to be from their perspective. And what does it mean to be a good person in community, and how are we supposed to take care of each other? And these were just very practical teachings that are so grounded in love and so grounded in relationship that I had just really lost my way and got separated from. So for me, like when I say decolonizing, which is a big term for folks, it's ultimately about unlearning a mainstream dominant worldview of leadership that can be oppressive and domineering, but unlearning that and relearning my indigenous ways of being and leading, which is so rooted in connection to people, love, and seeing people and the planet as my relative. And so that's the wisdom that I think has saved me personally. And I think it's wisdom that can save all of us and save this planet.
And that core message that you get as a professional, I've experienced this as a woman in the workplace, not nearly as much as people of color experience it, or women of color in particular, like this message of you need to be this person and this person is not you, right? Like this is who you need to be and it has nothing to do with who you are. And I was having this moment of reflection and still surprise, I don't know why, after I was watching the vice presidential debates. And I think both candidates did what they needed to do, right? And Kamala was phenomenal. And then the 5 minutes of commentary that started in the debrief, two female anchors essentially talking about what Kamala should have done differently to handle how Mike Pence was talking over her or breaking the rules, right? Not like, not how Mike Pence was talking over her or breaking the rules, but how Kamala should have managed herself better. And it was another, I mean, these examples are everywhere, every microsecond, right? We're seeing them, but still so ingrained is how do the folks in our community that are not white men translate their behaviors and ways of operating the world and their values so that we can operate within these structures. And even now when we are, the narrative is so strong and the awareness is so strong, we're still doing it.
Absolutely.
So I'm fascinated because philanthropy and the conversation around really changing the restrictions and the structures that the philanthropic sector can place on nonprofits and the communities that it is often has strong and positive intent to inform good change around, how that needs to start to loosen. And how does that, holding these ideas around real transformation of the sector and what's needed, and also working for a foundation, you work for the Schott Foundation for Public Education, which by the way is doing remarkable things in the community and is, my own personal opinion, is on the right side of philanthropy right now, but is still within the philanthropic sector. How do you think about your role within a foundation and as a change agent right now?
I think of my role as being a truth teller, and I feel like right now with so many lies, so many lies just circulating around, there's such an appetite for truth and honesty and being sincere. And I've been quite shocked, honestly, since the book came out, and I've been speaking around places because I didn't know what the response would be. And some of the truth I've been telling is kind of sort of on subjects that can be taboo to discuss within philanthropy. But I've really come to understand that people want to hear the truth. And if you deliver the truth in love, there really is a readiness to receive that. So that's really how I see my role. And I am not trying to dismantle or take the wheels off the bus of, you know, or be an anarchy kind of person necessarily. But what I want to do is actually see real change in the world. And, you know, I'm from North Carolina, where our state motto is to be rather than to seem. And I just remember that as a kid, like when I learned that in fourth grade, I was like, wow. And I think that's a part of who I actually am. If I'm going to talk about it, I want to be about it. And what we have in philanthropy is so much potential to be a part of transformative change in the world. And you know, we're doing good things, right? But good is not enough now, right? Considering the urgency, of climate change, considering the how we are on the verge of all kinds of systems collapsing, looking at where we are in terms of our progress around racial justice and racial healing, there's no time for just good work. We need like transformative work. And so part of where I feel like we got stuck in my sector is, you know, I attended conferences year after year after year after year where equity, equality, all of these things were buzzwords. But yet when we looked at where resources were actually going, the highest percentage of grant dollars that have ever gone to communities of color is only 8.5%, right? So I'm like, why am I spending 90% or 95% of my time in every philanthropic space talking about race and power and you know, justice and equity and all of these things? And we have all of these people of color on stage, and we have women talking about gender equality, and we have folks from the LGBT community. So like, that is the theme of every conference. But when we look at where money's going, because money talks, right, we still see such a small slither of resources going to these communities. And, you know, as a Native person, I can't tell you how many times I've seen Native people invited to sing and dance and to pray, do a prayer and an opening for a philanthropic conference. But yet our communities only get less than 1% of grants from foundations, right? So what's going on within the system that it's creating this redlining of communities of color from benefiting from these resources? And then when you layer on the historical aspect of like where money actually came from and how wealth was built in this country and who actually has wealth and has been privileged to build more and more wealth, we know that people of color have played significant roles in creating the bounty that we have in the U.S. And of course, through horrific acts of genocide and taking of land and, you know, slave trade. But you know, I worked in foundations that made, you know, the money from slave trade, right? From who the family owned slaves who worked their fields, and then to go to work every day and not be able to give some of that money back to Black communities, just there's just something that's not right about that. And so my role is to really shine a light on some of these complicated contradictions that we hold, because I think it's only through truth telling and acknowledging the truth and grieving that truth can we get through that to actually get to some real solutions. Because I don't want philanthropy or corporations or whoever to respond just in this moment and throw some dollars right quick to the movement for Black lives, move on. I really want us to get into a right relationship with community, one that is really authentic for the long haul, and to use these resources differently to achieve, see the justice that community is demanding.
And I think we're in a moment right now, right, where we're learning that actually massive transformation is possible almost overnight if we're all aligned, right? And I think that's what COVID has demonstrated to us. And I have that same hope, you know, where Common Impact has a lot of corporate clients. And one of the themes of our conversations has been, how do we move from this narrative around Black Lives Matter and nearly every company coming out and saying that, which is, that's still new, right? To a translation of that into not only philanthropic action, but actual change in business practice, where it's not just narrative flash in the pan and then, you know, when the headlines fade, so does the narrative and so do the actions. And would love to get your take. You know, one of the years long, if not decades long conversation in philanthropy has been this question of funding overhead, right? And restricted versus unrestricted funds. And the core hope for many folks in the social sector is, you know, philanthropy moving towards a place where it's allowing nonprofits and social change organizations to do what they think is best with the funds that they are given versus having it earmarked for X, Y, or Z. And that has developed new urgency in the context of COVID, because nonprofits have to do that, right? There's almost no choice.
Right.
And the recent surge in services required from nonprofits, specifically BIPOC-led and racial justice orgs. That was the first time I had heard that percentage point you mentioned, Edgar, that only 1% of Native organizations get philanthropic funding in this country. That is largely unheard and a big part of the challenge, right? So tell us your take on this whole topic of how we invest in these organizations and how philanthropy might move on this.
Sure. Yeah, for Native communities, it's actually less than 1%. It's like 0.04. I think, and I want to say for folks who don't work in philanthropy, if you're in the corporate sector or wherever, like what we're talking about today is just so relevant I've been meeting with a lot of folks in corporate America who are really sincere about wanting to show up in a different way, and even some radical notions of had this fascinating conversation recently with a couple business folks who were asking, how do we think about giving equity in our company to people of color as a form of reparations? So I think where the conversation is moving is to a place that's more radical. When it comes to giving funding to nonprofits in a way that is unrestricted, there has been research for decades saying that that is the most effective form of philanthropy, and it is the number one request from nonprofits. Why any funder has not moved to fund in that way is like, it boggles my mind, right? It's like, how many times do we have to research to demonstrate this? And, you know, I started at a foundation that did not give general operating support, that was programmatic, restrictive, and you know, even as a grant maker, it's not fun to even fund that way. Like, it's more work for you. And it's kind of like if you go out, this is my old analogy that I totally need to update, dating myself here, but it's like if you go out to wherever to buy a television and you start asking the salesperson, well, how much is this knob? And like, what if I... how much just for the speaker part of the TV, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, no, we don't do that. We just buy a whole television, right? And so when we're supporting a nonprofit, you know, giving funding to folks in a way that, frankly, it's not forcing them to make stuff up, right? It's stuff is being made up because foundations are asking for ridiculous, you know, data or information that's really impossible for folks to articulate. So it's really a form of control. And when it comes down to it, it's foundations have enjoyed a place of power and privilege, and being able to exercise that power over organizations to tell them how they need to do their work and what their theory of change needs to be. And we're really upside down in this, where we are so foundation and funder and donor centric in the nonprofit sector, when we really need to be community centric. I don't think that any foundation has the right to go into a community to say, this is what needs to be here and how you need to be doing your work. When they don't have, they're not from that community and they don't have relationships in that community. So it's just about trust. And, you know, so the least that a foundation can do is move funding and support nonprofits in a holistic way, understanding that, you know, there's no price tag really that can be put on the intervention and the services that are being offered. Where I want folks to go even beyond liberating themselves from restrictive grant making is to also just think about how dollars are liberated in a way that is more radical. And by this, kind of getting back to the example with the corporations who are thinking through, how do I give equity in my company? This for me, you know, when we think about equity, that word for me is about ownership, right? If you have equity in a home, how much equity you have is how much you own versus how much the bank may own, right? And so equity is the buzzword of the day, but what it really means to philanthropy If we think about what ownership really means of philanthropy, it means that we are actually turning ownership of the resources back over to community, and we don't get to have a say-so, right? Like, we are stewards of these resources that actually belong to the community. These are resources that were taken out of public coffers that would have been taxed and would have gone, to the government to provide safety net services and all the things we need in communities. But we had the luxury to say, no, we're going to put our money over here. And, you know, that's legal. And if we do that and we get major tax breaks to start foundations, that's totally fine. But we should honor that ownership being one that is shared with community. Where I'm pushing foundations now is beyond the grant making, beyond unrestricted, beyond the like desperate need to prioritize communities of color that have been marginalized at 8.5% that needs to go higher. What are we doing with our other assets that are the endowments that are in the bank? And how can we think about using that wealth in a way that is aligned with the mission of the organization, that is supporting the interests of community, and that is building wealth in communities? How can we even think about reparations and taking parts of those endowments out of the bank and actually handing them over to communities? That seems like something that's a really radical notion that I started saying 2 years ago, but there are actually foundations who are thinking through how to do this. There are foundations who are taking their, beyond grant making, taking their endowment, the real money, and saying, you know what, I'm going to actually hand this over and give it to Black folks, Native folks, to build wealth in the communities, and you decide how you want to use this money. And so that is where I want folks to imagine what is possible if we actually not only well-resourced communities, but we're thinking about the wealth that has been hoarded for decades in these philanthropic institutions. We're talking about $1 trillion of funding right now in America that is sitting in banks and being invested through Wall Street, often in harmful and extractive industries, right, that are actually hurting communities. What if we aligned our values for justice and equity across all of the resources under our roofs and found ways to take that wealth and put it back in communities, especially those communities from where it was originally extracted?
Well, and that is where companies and foundations examining not just where they're giving money away, but how they are not only where they build wealth from, but how they're currently building wealth, right, is often counter to what they're saying and what they're giving to, and also much more significant amount of money that they're holding on to than they're giving away in general. And one of the other conversations that has been reactivated during COVID is this 5% payout, right, of foundations where every year they are asked to give 5% of their money away, or that's the minimum, but it's treated as a maximum, and how that might change. I think part of what you're sharing is that, right? Like, how do we think about really realigning our values on where and how much we're investing in the right now versus in the wealth cultivation? So you were named an angelic troublemaker to reset America. And if anyone has listened closely to this podcast, I think they know what that means. What advice would you give to listeners who are ready to be troublemakers for good? These terms scare people, right? Decolonizing, defunding, dismantling, and it's really hard for people to get over those barriers. I don't know if that's I mean, it's certainly more than branding, but you have started to really make progress there. What would you recommend for individuals who are listening and want to do the same?
Yeah, you know, I would say one is do not underestimate the power of storytelling. And if anything, writing this book has taught me that, you know, kind of being vulnerable, putting my story out, it really does have the power to shift hearts and minds. Those terms are really scary for sure. And I can remember being on tour and being at events where we had our big Decolonize the Wealth banner out and folks walking in kind of looking a little afraid or, you know, not coming to the book table to buy their merch right away until after the program where they, you know, bought us out. And it's where, you know, and what happened within that hour of time that I got to spend with folks was really just storytelling. We, by human nature, are just influenced by the power of story. And, you know, I get asked a lot about backlash or are there folks who are really, you know, within philanthropy or other places trying to shut us down. And the answer has really been no, not really, because I'm doing this work from a very deeply personal place of telling my story. And my story is like not up for debate, right? Like it is my story and it's what I've been through and what has happened. And so folks who are looking to make change, you've got to really tap into the story of why and what's motivating you to do it and what have you been through that you can share. Because ultimately that is going to be, you know, more powerful than any like data points that I can pull out and all of that. There's got to be the element of storytelling in there. So that's been a way that I have brought people into a conversation, because within the pain points that I share of what I've been through, everybody, no matter who people are, everyone can relate to pain and they can feel it in the storytelling, and it creates this openness to want to understand that and to change that for the future. The other thing that I think is really important, and especially in this moment, because we're so torn apart in the US and, you know, identity politics and, you know, the social media feeds are designed for, you know, to really create this mirror of thinking that everyone is like us. And if they're not like us, they are like horrific people. You know, I stand often and find myself in the middle or as a bridge person. And I think that's because I come from the South, from a very conservative family. I'm Native American and I've always been in that other box. So it's not that I agree with or can see both sides of the issues, because I definitely believe in a right and a wrong. And I definitely believe that there is a time to fight, right? Like we can't stand by when people are literally being murdered. But I think that we have got to find a way as people who are called to lead change in organizations or in community, we have got to find a way to be bridge builders, and we've got to find a way to have more grace and empathy towards other folks that may not be like us. And, you know, I sometimes share the story of, you know, just where I came from and who I am, because I get put on a pedestal as this very progressive, forward-thinking person. And 25 years, I could not have been any further away from the person I am today, right? I was in a different political party. I believed a totally different set of things. I was in a right-wing evangelical church, right? And so how did I find my way out of that ideology to this place now of what I believe, right? That I, what I believe now with the fervency that I have, I believed it just as fervently back then, something very different. And it came about because there were people who had grace for me and taught me and led me through a journey. And I think sometimes today when people, if it's their first day, you know, to the table or to the movement, we're ready to criticize and judge and nail people to the wall if they say one wrong thing. And so somewhere we've got to find a way to develop the skill set to see common humanity in others, even if they're very different from us. And I know that's hard, but I think part of the reason that my work is effective is I walk into any room and I'm willing to sit down and have any conversation. And have some level of, I don't even know if respect is the right word, because I don't know that I actually do respect every person that I've met with or the people I'm talking to, but I believe in their potential for change. And I believe that if I can, if I'm the person with the right answer and the person who's holding truth, then I should be holding that truth with joy and with love. And that's a skill and a growth that I have I guess just like developed through the years that I think is just so important in these times. No one's going to change who they vote for if we are, you know, screaming in their face, you know, or like, you know, calling them names on social media. But if we can actually find a way to say, you know what, I hear you, but I want to tell you a story, and that may change your mind if you'll give me a minute, right? That you might find an openness, because the truth is, regardless of, you know, where we come from, who we are, what we've been through, everybody has experienced some level of pain and suffering. And, you know, for white folks that I'm working with, I'm working to help them to understand that white supremacy is like their problem and it's harming their families, right? And when people can see that self-interest hook in there, they're willing to come to the table and be a part of a solution. So that's really important. And the last thing I'll say is just be bold. Like, this is the time where we can use the language we want to use more than ever, talking about race, talking about justice, transformation, decolonizing. Like, it is the language of the day. Don't be afraid to say white supremacy, because, you know, it is the ideology. It's not white people that we're against, but we're against this false ideology that is tearing our country apart. And so this is the time for all of us to be very bold.
I love that. It's so powerful that you have that personal experience, which I think is part of what allows the bridge, right? It's really empathizing with understanding that you can have fervent beliefs in very different places and still have a common humanity and want to do good in the world, and being open to that conversation. And in my experience, we're just so much less polarized at heart, at our core, than our headlines would have us believe, right? And if you just open that conversation without judgment and hear where the other person is coming from, you know, it's not easy from there, but it gets a lot more straightforward how we create change together. And, you know, my personal experience with this recently is I will never know what it is like to be a person of color, a woman of color, that is experiencing everyday systemic racism. I can intellectualize it. I can recognize it. I can fight against it, but I will never truly empathize. I had a moment in April when we had just kind of murder after murder of Black Americans, right? And I, with Breonna Taylor, thought of her mother. And I have two young kids, right? So I know what it's like to be a mother. And I know that all you want to do is make your kids happy. And all you want to do is protect your kids. And the idea of anything, even scraping them, is horrific to you, right? Let alone what happened to Breonna. And like, when I tapped into that, it brought me to a different place and a different fervency around the racial justice issues, that it became much more emotional than rational and intellectual. And I think that's part of what we have to figure out, right? We have to tap into the dimension of this that's about our humanity and the pieces of it that we really can empathize with.
Absolutely.
So before we hit record, you shared with me that you're also in Brooklyn, New York, which we're talking in the beginning of October, is beautiful weather, and also it's starting to increase in cases of COVID. So it feels like we're heading into a tough time, and imagine we'll all be kind of in a virtual environment for a while longer. We'll see how much longer. And imagine your days look a little different these days than they did at the beginning of the year. But would love to hear what's the best part of your day.
You know, I think I definitely have been working a lot. A lot of the work that I'm doing is fundraising and moving money to communities that have been most impacted by COVID. And we're also raising and moving money to Black-led organizations working for racial justice. And so that's been my medicine, just through our fund, Liberated Capital at Decolonizing Wealth, when we're able to give a grant of $5,000, $10,000, $25,000. One, the folks who are just participating in giving, right, is like, it's awesome to see the numbers of folks who are standing up in this moment. We've had over 1,200 people to give. And then just seeing what folks are doing with the resources and the mutual aid and the what's happening on the ground in communities that like the Navajo community and the Hopi Reservation that we've been supporting, the Lumbee tribe back in my community in North Carolina, the way people are taking care of each other and realizing, I think for me, that if there's any silver lining, which that sounds like a crazy thing to say, but in all of this is I do see that I feel like we're remembering our collective humanity and knowing that we can't count on the government or, you know, corporations or foundations or charities to actually take care of us, right? Like they show up when they do, but we have to take care of each other. And I'm seeing beautiful, beautiful demonstrations of that every single day. So that helps me get out of bed every morning and gives me the hope that we will get to the other side of all of this.
Indeed. Indeed. How beautiful. Well, thank you, Edgar, for joining us today. It's just been lovely. I'm not eager to let you go. it's been great to hear a little bit about your background and how you think about the work that you do. And just thank you again for your contribution to the field and the space and really, fighting this inside outside battle with philanthropy and being able to speak up and speak your truth and a truth that I think a lot of folks in the social sector really believe and really welcome that perspective. So thank you, and hope you'll join us back in a couple months, maybe when we're on the other side of this.
Absolutely. You take care.
Thanks so much for listening to Pro Bono Perspectives today. If you like our show and want to learn more, check out our website at commonimpact.org. Leave us a review and tell your friends and colleagues about us. Tune in to our upcoming episodes to hear from everyday leaders using their skills to help their communities.